from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Jamie Court is president of Consumer Watchdog and a long-term grassroots and populist organizer and activist. He'll join us in studio to talk this hour about raising hell, which he has been doing for years in fights with HMOs, banks, insurance, and oil companies, and drug manufacturers. His new book is titled The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, and its subtitle is How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. Jamie Court, next on Forum. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Consumer Watchdog President Jamie Court joins us in studio for this Forum hour. He's a frequent commentator on Marketplace and on the Los Angeles Times op-ed page. And his new book is called The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. He joins us for the second hour. And good to see you again. Welcome.
It's my pleasure to be back.
This is a roadmap, a toolkit, it's a manifesto, it's all of the above, and we'll talk about it. But first, we got to talk about this decision in Virginia with you. Actually, let me hold off on that. First, let's talk about the word progressive, because it's in the title, and it's becoming one of those words like liberal that's getting demonized more and more each day, thanks to Glenn Beck and others.
And I feel like progressive, how should progress ever be demonized, but somehow moving forward, using government, using civil society to help people is now being something that is the antithesis of what the right wants government to be.
Right, well, it doesn't want government to be in people's lives. That's kind of it, isn't it?
And yet we have an office on Capitol Hill, and I see the right walk around, and they seem to enjoy the life that government gives them. So, yeah, I find the Tea Party, for instance, a fascinating phenomenon. You know, populism to me is such a powerful force. It's the most powerful force in the world when 70% of Americans agree on something. And there's so many areas for progress that 70% of Americans agree on. That's why we called the book The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, because in 2008 we agreed on progress for affordable health care. We agreed on limiting the oil companies and our dependence. We agreed on trying to get out of the wars. These are still areas where there's broad consensus. I mean, there's 60-70% of support from San Francisco to New York to Kansas to Indiana, if you look at discrete issues here. And yet,
Chris, it depends on the way you frame them. I was just thinking with healthcare, for example, there's still, I believe, a majority of Americans who don't like what they call Obamacare because the way it's been framed and the way it's been presented.
Right. And there are parts of that reform that no one likes. About 70-80% oppose mandatory health insurance, depending upon how you frame it. Even when you talk about everyone's got to buy mandatory health insurance in order – that health insurance has to be mandatory in order for it to be more cost-effective for all of us, you can't get more than 40% support from Americans. This is from the Kaiser Family Foundation in August. We've always opposed mandatory health insurance because it is so unpopular. That really sinks the rest of the bill. Because subsidies for low-income people to buy health insurance, 60-70% of Americans support that this summer. These are fairer rules for health insurers to make them play fair in the marketplace, something we've been fighting for a long time. We got 70% support. There's 70% support for premium regulation, which we don't have. So the things that are progressive in health reform have huge support. The things that have tanked Obama are the things that aren't popular. When he veered away from popular opinion, and the biggest flip-flop, the biggest mistake of his presidency, and it may cost him his presidency, is the flip-flop on mandatory health insurance. On the campaign trail, he said, I think the reason people don't have health insurance isn't because they don't want it, it's because they can't afford it. Then he bowed to the Washington logic that you have to have mandatory health insurance purchases if you have health insurers sell everybody a policy regardless of their medical condition. And it's a fallacy.
He also caved on public option, of course, and they made people in your progressive camp very angry because of that. But let's talk about what happened in Virginia, because Republicans are calling it a huge victory. The decision in federal district court declaring individual mandate provision of the Obama health care law unconstitutional. And in fact, what the Republicans and the right is saying is this bodes well for the Texas lawsuit, which is going against Obamacare.
Well, you know, I remember called. When Obamacare actually wasn't a bad word. when I started to talk about it in 2008, it wasn't a bad word. Look, the good thing about the Virginia case is this is a judge, a George W. Bush appointee, who said mandatory health insurance, the notion that the state can force people to buy health insurance, a private market commodity, is something that's unconstitutional. The federal government can't do that. That's different than a taxing power. And he said the rest of the health care reform law stands.
But, now, of course, the GOP now is going to have a majority, and they're going to try to dismantle this whole thing that's called Obamacare.
Well, they're not going to be able to. They're not going to be able to take it apart, at least for another election cycle. But the thing is, let's play this out, Michael. What if the court said mandatory health insurance, as they did yesterday, is wrong, but the rest, the progressive parts of Obamacare stand? Why wouldn't that be something that Obama and the White House would cheer? You know, the mandatory health insurance provision is the noose that has sunk this whole health reform plan. The public option disappeared, yes, and I was very frustrated. And what progressives did largely is say, well, maybe we'll accept the mandatory provision if we get the public option. And then suddenly Obama acted like a caretaker for the public option, not an advocate when it finally disappeared. And so I think there's some hope, and I talk in the book about how the state, and California in particular, but 24 states with ballot measures, have some hope to resurrect the public option, to create premium regulation. Because what's immoral, frankly, about mandatory health insurance is the fact that there's no regulation of how much the insurance companies can charge you, and yet the state's telling you you have to buy health insurance. And we are working in California, and we hope it starts in other states, to regulate health insurance premiums the way we regulate auto insurance premiums, to say insurance companies can't raise rates without asking permission from our elected insurance commissioner. But these were things that were off the table federally. And so to me, Obama's failure is really about his abandonment of public opinion, and the mandatory health insurance provision of the health reform law is something that isn't good for the rest of the reform law. Now, the fear is that if they strike down the mandatory provision, they're going to also strike down some of the more generous and beneficial consumer protections. That didn't happen yesterday, and it could happen in the Supreme Court. There is a fallacy, though, we have to deal with, this notion that you have to force people to buy health insurance if you force health insurance companies to sell it to everybody. I just don't think that's real, and I think there's some ways we can prove that that's not real. Massachusetts has a mandate to buy health insurance. It has the most expensive health insurance premiums in the nation. Other states have laws that say, no, you have to insure everybody, and you can't charge them based on their medical condition. Those states actually have lower premiums. So there's all sorts of ways to cut this up, and it really comes down to what the public is willing to demand. And I think at the ballot measure, a process in California, as I talk about in the book, that's where our demands can be heard. We can actually put a measure on the ballot to create a public option as an alternative to the private market. We can also create a measure that says we can regulate premiums. And if mandatory health insurance weren't part of this equation, we could in California, our eighth largest economy in the world, maybe have what we didn't get as progressives in Washington, D.C. in 2008, a reform.
Just like we've established our own environmental laws, really, in effect, yeah.
Absolutely, and they survived. This was so hopeful to me, this election. Around the rest of the country, progressives were weeping. And to me, in California, you know, exposing oil companies who spent tens of millions of dollars to using the Tea Party as a front group or as a group.
California is almost an oasis unto itself in many ways. I mean, not only because the state in the midterm election went entirely Democratic, but because of the kind of politics that you're talking about. I even heard Rush Limbaugh say, I've given up on California, you know, which maybe progressives could be very celebratory toward. But the fact of the matter is that it almost stands apart in many respects now, doesn't it?
It does. Well, besides having Democrats in every top office, despite the fact that a woman spent $160 million to take the governor's office as a corporate CEO and a nanny, an undocumented nanny, and how she was treated by the CEO or former CEO stopped her from becoming governor. I mean, that's populism to me. What I love about California, and while we have an office in D.C., I love living here, is you can go directly to the people, and the people can make a statement. Now,
populism now nationally, though, is the Tea Party, really. That's got the juice right now much more than a populist progressive movement.
Do you see a populist progressive movement anywhere outside of, you know, the ballot measure in California? I don't see it. And I think that's the answer. And that's what we talk about in the book, is how do you get that going? I see the opportunity at the state level, the 24 states with ballot measure process. I see the opportunity with social media and the internet. I mean, we have the most anti-corporate, anti-Wall Street environment in American history. And progressives aren't translating it into victories. And the reason is, we've relied on the president to do it for us. And it's pretty clear for me a while ago.
I did get a Wall Street reform bill through.
A Wall Street reform bill that has allowed Wall Street to collect huge bonuses. I don't know if anyone believes that's reform Wall Street. I do believe.
Before the tax cuts, in fact, they put bonuses in place. You know that.
Yes, I do. And they could. The other thing is the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which could become a watchdog for consumers in a real way, but it's going to rely consistently on who's in the executive branch and how hard he is on Wall Street. So, or she. So I see in America an opportunity to learn from California. I see the social media that we have. MoveOn pioneered it right out of the Bay Area, how to build movements. But there's really some searching for answers now. Everybody's kind of scratching their head.
What happened to MoveOn, though? I mean, in the midterm election, we got 5 million people, and they really went out and rallied for Obama. But Obama simply wasn't really connecting with people the way he was in his original election in the midterm. He was trying to, but he really didn't do it.
Well, this is the authenticity. I talk in the book about rules of populist power. And the reason Obama was so effective is he's an outsider. And to be effective, I believe, if you're a raisin hell or if you're really trying to change something big, you have to at least act like an outsider, which means you have to be willing to go after insiders who don't believe what the public believes, who stand against public opinion and the movement for change. The big thing to me with Obama, take health reform. He put in charge of health reform a guy named Max Baucus. The architect of health reform is the guy, one of our first studies in D.C. showed he was the biggest money getter from the health insurance industry on Capitol Hill. And the drug companies gave him a lot of money too. And here's the guy who's the architect of reform. Now, if you're the president, I know there's a powerful guy who's the head of the finance committee, but you're saying, look, I want a public option. The people who put me here want real change. Here's what you're going to do, or here's what I'm going to do to you. That's not the way this president talks to people in his own party who stood in the way of reform.
Presidents always get co-opted and move. If they're on the left, they move to the center. If they're the right, they move to the center. It just seems to be the pattern over and over again, doesn't it?
And as Jim Hightower says, when you're in the middle of the road, you get run over by the big truck.
Or if you're Jamie Court, you say you got to get the people active. And that's really what your book is all about. You got to get them to the point where, like, Harry Rosenfield, who I know was an ally of yours, and you guys brought Prop 103 in, and it saved Californians over $60 billion over 20 years in auto insurance costs. I mean, you've had an extraordinary track record. You get up in the morning and say, I got to get the bastards. But getting people energized with that kind of feeling.
Well, I read the newspaper every morning, and that gets me energized because I get angry.
You got little kids, too. That
and
helps.
I got little kids, and they jump all over me and wake me up, and that helps, too. But when I get angry, you know, the book is really about how do you turn anger into change. I mean, that's what the Tea Party has turned anger. I don't know what's turned into change, but they have seized on popular anger. And if they're the only people out there seizing on anger, focusing it like a light on candidates, that works, but it also works on issues. What we talk about in the book is really not just how you can go to the ballot box if you want to file an initiative, if you're angry about something, how you go about winning a ballot measure battle, because we've won some on insurance reform. We've pioneered some on health insurance and HMO patients' rights in the 90s.
You forced Mercury Insurance to have lower rates.
This last election, we beat a $16 million campaign by Mercury Insurance to repeal some very key consumer protections. We outspent 12 to 1. It's all about David versus Goliath Moose. This last election, the insurance companies tried to spend $5 million to elect very surreptitiously their choice of a candidate for insurance commissioner. We exposed that. Others exposed that. And the insurance companies didn't prevail. The guy who didn't take the insurance industry money won. So it's really all about exposing the injustice, confronting the troublemakers, and then putting your teeth in the tail till you get the change.
And making people aware. I mean, even if it comes down to the sort of thing like, Dick Puck type of stuff. I mean, you're not necessarily beneath, say, bringing a pig into the hall of government, that sort of thing.
Well, we've done that over health reform mergers. You become handlers of much livestock when you're in my trade. I remember the merger between WellPoint and Anthem. years ago in order to get the CEO salaries compensation the merger down, which we ultimately did. We brought some live pigs into the hearing. You know, we've dealt with getting a message out. And really what it comes down to is when you don't have money, when you have public opinion on your side, but you don't have money, what do you do to get people aware about what kind of injustice you're trying to stop and who stands in your way? And too many advocacy groups, I mean, this goes back to, you mentioned Move On, who I think generally are pretty good, but the Washington establishment, the public interest groups in Washington on both sides have their role. And generally, the right will attack the left's president and the left will support the left's president. And so we really haven't had public interest groups doing enough to hold Obama's feet to the fire. You hear the Tea Party holding Obama's feet to the fire, but we don't have populist progressive groups doing that.
I'd like to see populists holding all politicians' feet to the fire, making them accountable, making them transparent, making them stop taking so much money.
Yeah, I agree with that. The problem in Washington is too much raising money, not enough raising hell. And we've done it in California pretty well, and we've done it with Democrats and Republicans. D.C. is always harder because the values there are so far removed from California's values, from populist values. I think we've had some successes in breaking through on a couple issues. In health reform, there's some very good provisions that I would not want to see go away. Provisions that say you can't be canceled for an innocent omission on your enrollment application. Provisions that say that you have to be sold a policy regardless of your medical condition and has to be reflective of something other than your medical condition. These are important protections. And those were won through a lot of hard work in California and elsewhere, making opinion leaders and officials realize there was a problem in the market. Our big problem as a movement, though, is we have leaders who have to be shown that there is a downside to abandoning principle.
Talking to Consumer Watchdog President Jamie Court, his new book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. And that we is very important here because we were talking about should it have been you voted for or we voted for. You're trying to get this we now of populace, aware of concern about Google and Don't Be Evil. And Eric Schmidt, I saw the video that you put out. Eric Schmidt, never thought it was quite the villain holding out ice cream to kids like a pedophile. I mean, it was pretty.
Let me defend.
Pretty strong attack.
Well, first of all, it used his own words against him. You know, the point of this was we're trying to get a do not track me list, and the Federal Trade Commission finally 2 weeks ago, actually at our privacy conference in D.C., remarkably, Consumer Watchdog's privacy conference, announced they're in favor of a do not track me list, which is great. You go on the internet, you build something in a browser, it stops tracking. Well, Google hasn't been a fan of that, and the CEO, Schmidt, has said quite a lot of things, like maybe kids when they get older should change their names, because of what we know about them on the internet. Not that we should have more privacy, but maybe they should change their names. He said some really offensive things, and we've used some of those remarks against him in this one Don't Be Evil video. I mean, here's a good example. In the book, I talk about how forcing an opponent's mistake is the goal of advocacy. Most groups want to educate people, which is great. But if you really want to create change, you're going to have to take on a powerful opponent and force them to make a mistake. Well, Schmidt's words are what creates many of these mistakes. Recently, he said, and you'll see the next installment of this cartoon campaign.
He's still driving an ice cream truck?
He's driving an ice cream truck to Capitol Hill. And we'll see what happens there. But he made some statements about how we know what you think before you think it. We'll be able to give you search results before you even search, so you don't even have to search. You know, the goal here for, I think, Google, which, you know, there's no question that their founders have been altruistic, and it's one of the reasons we can force them to make changes as we have in their privacy policies and in the protections, is to basically know
altruistic
everything.
Or social conscience? Is there
When I say altruistic, I mean, see, they've been generous to charities, and they also created it, I believe, out of an idea of opening information to everyone and making more available. But the problem is, if you take that to its logical extreme, which is where it's going, and you create it open to Wall Street financing, and you have the pressures of Wall Street on your back, suddenly that means no one should ever have any privacy, because opening the world's information to everyone is great, but what Google really is an advertising company. And what it does is it gets 98% of its revenue from advertising. So it tries to find everything out about us that we can through our searches, through the sites we visit, through which it tracks through its ad programs, and then advertises based on our tracking, which is fine if we consent to it. They're unwilling to let us say we want to be anonymous. And talking about populism.
But you're also concerned about net neutrality with Google, aren't you?
Well, they've just changed positions on net neutrality. At some point they were neutral. And again, this is Wall Street pressure. They've decided they need to have two toll lanes on the internet. But here, on privacy, what's important, I think, in the context of raising hell is we did a poll. 90% of Americans, this was this summer, want legislation to protect their online privacy. 80% want a do not track me list or mechanism. Now, that is huge. We have that power. I predict that within a year, we're going to have a do not track me mechanism, not just in Microsoft's browser, which happened last week, but something that every major browser has. And it's because of the power of populism. That's going to get us some progress. And it's something that we couldn't have done but for taking a CEO's words, holding it against him. We got 500,000 views on that cartoon that was donated to us, by the way. You can find it at insidegoogle.com. It basically is I like the metaphor that you can't – there is no free ice cream. And that's what I think Google has said, is that, you know, you can use our services – and they're for free, and it's all safe and private. Well, the services are often for free, but it's not safe and private, and people should understand the risks and have in their control the ability to say no to the tracking. So I love this issue because we're going to win on this issue, and because both sides of the aisle are going to thank us for winning, and because a company that, you know, does good things is still going to do good things, but they're also going to have to listen to us when we say don't track us.
So let's talk about tactics again. I mean, there you are with animated things on the internet, many, many hits. You're using social networks.
Well, it's the most conductive medium ever. We didn't see the explosion of social media, you know, until 2009, really. Twitter became more popular than all the major news sites combined. Facebook's traffic is unbelievable. It surpasses all the news organizations. And people, while if we can get some privacy protections on the internet, because this is something people are turning out of Facebook too when there's not enough privacy, we can keep it a system where if you have a problem and you create, and this is one of the rules of populist power, we talk about a really human, authentic story about what happened to you that's wrong. You put it on the internet. A million people can see it, can respond to it, can support your effort to change it. Now, in my very limited history on this earth, I've never seen a mechanism where at your computer, if you get the creative product just right, the story just right, the tone just right, maybe add some humor, you can get a million people to support you. And when a million people support, you can do anything. I'm thinking of the guy whose son came back from Fort Bragg and came back from Iraq, went to Fort Bragg, and the conditions were just deplorable. The ceilings coming in, the bathroom stopped up, the pipes breaking. And he took a video of it, put it on YouTube. And guess what happened? Millions of people saw it. Then the TV media saw it. And then those conditions changed. And things happen real quickly. So that type of moment is something we shouldn't forget when we're being so depressed about Washington, D.C.
Jamie Cort's book is The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. And you can join us. In fact, we welcome you joining this conversation, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Feel free to join the program. Any questions or comments you have, it's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free number to join our conversation, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Jamie Cort, and his book is called The Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For. Jamie Cort, longtime activist and also president of the Consumers Watchdog Group, which is out of Los Angeles. And you can hear him, of course, on Public Radio's Marketplace, where he frequently holds forth. He also writes for the Los Angeles Times. And we're going to get our callers involved in this discussion right away. And we'll go first to you, Diane. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I can't wait to read your book. I'm pretty excited about reading it, actually. I wanted you to, if you could comment on, you said earlier that you felt like Obama didn't connect with the people in the midterms, and consequently, this, you know, he took the shellacking or whatever, you know, what he said. But I was thinking that, you know, people, most people don't vote in the midterms. I mean, the lines out were out the door when he to vote for his presidency, but midterms are just are boring. I mean, even a longtime voter like myself, and I always vote. They're boring elections, and you try to force yourself to go there or to mail in your ballot or just to read it. And to claim that, you know, he lost when it was like just probably a quarter of the people voted, and that the Republicans got some kind of mandate. All the people that voted probably were going to, nothing was going to convince them.
Well,
anyway.
I think, excuse me, Diane, I think has hit on a very important point. You want to get citizens activated. You want to get populist movement. How do you overcome the apathy that makes sometimes other than 50% even willing to go to the voting precincts?
Well, you know, it involves if you're trying to get people activated, it involves, you know, exposing, you know, problems they identify with, confronting the people, the cause of the problems, you know, fighting for change. This is a thing that he did.
You know, like those billionaires who wanted him tax cuts.
Thank you, Wall Street. These are the things he did really well as an outsider to energize independents, to energize Democrats, even energize some Republicans in 2008. We still wanted all those things we voted for. But what happened, obviously, by the midterm was it was less clear that we were going to get those things. The public lost a lot of faith, if you look in public, that in polling, that Obama was going to deliver them. And I think it's really this difference between an outside and inside game. Can you ever in the White House be an outsider who exposes corruption in the Capitol as a way of getting change for the public? I think you can be. Clearly, the public thought that's what they were getting. That's not what Obama delivered, and a lot of people were very unhappy about it. But is there a way to get the president to energize his base and independents again? I think that's the real critical question. And the problem I hear in the media right now is the way to do it, it's this group that just was announced yesterday, No Labels. We're not Republican or Democrat. Let's meet in the middle. Let's have a bipartisan solution. Well, I'll tell you, bipartisan solutions got us TARP. That's what a bipartisan solution is. A nonpartisan solution gets you global warming caps, campaign finance reform, real protections from health insurance companies and their pricing practices. Those are the things he was talking. He wasn't talking bipartisan in 2008. He was talking nonpartisan. He was talking uber partisan. He was saying, I'm an outsider.
But here's the argument, and in the core of the argument. President comes in and really, to some extent, the undergirding of his campaign is no more of these tax cuts for the rich. I mean, he says this, it becomes a clarion call, it becomes a centerpiece, really, of his campaign. Then he deals with hard-boiled politics, and he deals with Republicans who say, these people on unemployment aren't going to get any more insurance unless you come across and go along with us. And essentially, he said, I've got to compromise. I worry about these middle-class people. They're not getting unemployment. Compromise is the nature of how politics, you know, you don't want to see it made and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to have to go along with him. I think that's pretty much what happened, isn't it?
Right, but it's all how you play the game, how you play the game of poker, what your opening bid is, how hard and how tough you are.
But he's hurt himself with his base so much by saying, by going, it's like Bush won saying no more taxes, and then he went against them, and it really messed him up with his base.
Absolutely, there's no question that the public, and this is what I love about the public, they get authentic, they get what's real, they hear him reversing these key campaign pledges. It's a lot like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger came into office, you remember, with 70% approval rating on this recall election. And he made one big mistake that we picked up on real quickly, if you recall. He said, I'm going to come in. I'm not going to take money from special interest groups. I don't need their money. I'm not going to do their
money. I'm going to blow up boxes.
But he said, I'm going to take on special interest. Then he took, ultimately, over $129 million from special interest groups. But he said corporations, this was his big mistake, are not special interest groups. Only unions and Indian tribes that do business with the state. And we created a whole website called arnoldwatch.org to expose his hypocrisy on day one, throwing the definition of special interest back at him. And if you recall from – this was in 2003 in December he won the recall – And by 2005, his popularity had gone from, you know, like 60-70% down to around 30% when he was on the eve of a special election he called to do some very right-wing initiatives to help a lot of those people, those special interest groups that he was not supposedly helping.
You're a lot more hopeful about Jerry Brown, because certainly from the other side of the political spectrum, they're saying he's too in debt to the teachers' unions, for example.
Here I am hopeful, and I'll tell you why, not only because I have no choice, but I'm hopeful because I don't think he's looking for another term. I don't think he's looking to make a name for himself. I don't think he's looking to be famous like Schwarzenegger was. I think Schwarzenegger wanted another act he liked to be liked. I think he was doing with – and that's why he came back after that shellacking he took in 2005 and did global warming limits. He did minimum wage. He did some other progressive stuff, and he turned off his party completely. The Democrats never truly believed him, so his opinion rating right now when he's leaving office is the same as Gray Davis's when he was recalled in the 20s. But I think that Jerry Brown's not that type of politician. My belief about Jerry is he knows what he's got saddled with. He doesn't know what to do about it. And so he's getting how difficult this job is, and he's not going to make big mistakes. He's not going to cave into the unions. There was a moment in the campaign where he said, and he didn't hang up the phone, or his aide said, and it was on a union leader's phone, a voicemail, and it was given to the reporters. He called his opponent a word I'm not even going to say. That's not a nice word for women, because he said, she's going to give everything away to the unions. I'm not going to do that, and that's why, you know, she knows what she's doing, but I'm going to play tough. And I believe that was an authentic moment, because he doesn't have to give anything away to anyone.
Let's get more of our callers on here. We go next to Brad. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for having me. My question is I think it's time that we have four or up to five different political parties. And it's an urgent principle if we're going to make any true changes. And the reason I'm saying this is because with the system the way it's set up now, it's like two teams. They're like sports teams, literally. And you have 43%, and some 4% middle that theoretically is going to tip the scale. But you really can't get anything done. You have a system which can be blocked through Congress, and everything can stay the same through filibustering and all the other different blocking methods. So until we have or move towards, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, a more parliamentary system where coalitions are built and legislation can be passed and changed in a stable manner, and not just through the whim of 2 years this, 2 years that, or never. It's never really going to be any true drastic change. It's not going to happen.
Well, you know, I think the problem is that we focus all our energy on elections when what happens between elections matters more. Now, we're all busy. We work jobs, so it's easier to vote every 2 years or 4 years and think, you know, we're voting for someone who's going to represent us. But the truth is they know you're not looking the other 2 years between elections. And if we don't start holding politicians accountable, and then the book is a roadmap for how you can do it if you really want to, you will never get the change you voted for, because the interest groups, the insurance companies, the oil companies, the military industrial complex are working every day on Capitol Hill. If we're not working every day, even if it's 5 minutes from our computer, finding a platform we can plug into, putting a message out there through our networks, doing what we can to take on politicians who represent us but maybe betray us, if we don't do that, then when we vote again, we're going to be disappointed again. And so to me, it's not electoral politics that's the answer. It's what you can do between elections. And I think history's borne that out on issues where people have engaged between elections.
And Brad, thank you for your call. Let me get some more callers on. We'll go to Calistoga. Frederick, join us. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. I wanted to propose to you, Jamie, a vision or an overarching frame for the progressive movement, because I hear you talking about singular issues, and I agree with you. But while you said, Michael, that the conservatives or the right want to diminish and lower the amount of government in our lives, I feel the progressives need to take a hold of the vision of good governance, of examples of the public good, of our highway system, the public schools, universities, our grand national parks. We could stand behind, a moniker of the public good versus privatization and the private greed. that conservatism stands for. So we draw a clear distinction, Jamie, in every conversation we have, that the negative that we talk to is privatization and the greed that's inherent in capitalism, and that we progressives stand for the public good. Let me just finish by saying when President Obama proposed health care, he was speaking into this vast vacuum. A government system at this time had no chance, because to go to the public realm is anathema. It's too treacherous right now to go to the public realm, well, to go to government for a solution. But I'm proposing, Michael and Jamie, that we develop as progressives the movement based on the public good, and look at the tremendous history in this culture of public expenditure, and take straight on the conservative movement to dismantle government and privatize all of our lives.
Now, you know,
what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a great idea. You know, George Lakoff, we were just talking about on the break, is a friend of ours, talks always to us about the moral mission of government and how we've got to talk about the moral mission of government to protect us from certain things. I mean, online privacy invasions is a good example of a moral mission of government, 70%, 80% public support. But my vision probably doesn't differ much from yours. But what I know is with limited resources or anyone as an individual, if we are going to get involved, we can't build the type of apparatus the other side has to change the zeitgeist of our culture. What we can do with our individual action is take on something that really gets us angry, and it generally will not only change the problem that you're trying to change, it will also likely be a beacon for others to see what you're doing and putting into practice how you can get government working more effectively or accountably to do something that's progressive. I mean, I remember we fixed this issue on health insurance cancellations over innocent omissions on an enrollment application. We call it rescission. And some of the first court cases, we helped get the documents out to expose this issue. And we talked about it for a lot. And I was really shocked when the HMO executives went to Congress, and one of the only confrontational hearings on health reform was when the HMO executives went up and said, yeah, we're going to have to cancel people even if it wasn't intentional on their enrollment application that they left something off. If it wasn't a lie, we're still going to have to cancel them. We have that duty to our shareholders. And Joe Barton, the most right-wing Republican, got so angry, and the Democrats, of course, didn't like it, and it became a bipartisan rallying cry. And I thought, wow, you know, if we hadn't gotten some documents out from some court cases to show how big a problem this was, this would never would have happened. And that is something that people remember about health care reform. So I think you got to put it into practice. We don't have the resources. And Lakoff, I think I would love to give George Lakoff $10 million if I had it. If anyone out there can do it, write him a check so that we can have an institute that goes around and talks about how the moral mission of government is to fight greed on Wall Street and other places and to show a framework. But we don't have the capacity necessarily to do it, or it hasn't been deployed that way. So I think what we got to do is take matters into our own hands on a daily basis and prove it by example.
I think George would certainly welcome that sum or something even close to it. Thank the caller. I'm wondering, though, about when you talk about resources and healthcare and about priorities, if government is going to serve the people, then government needs more resources. It needs more revenue, plain and simple. And there are those who have criticized the fact that there's been too much emphasis, for example, on health care reform and not on the economy of this particular administration. And maybe if there had been more emphasis on the economy, we'd be out of this ditch that we're in and would be able to be doing better. And therefore, government could serve people more.
Absolutely. If you're a populist, look at the polls. What's the top issue? Jobs.
So maybe people should be concentrating their energy more on the economy? The argument would go?
The problem is we can't individually – I think that would be the argument. The problem is the president could create jobs through a national full employment or close to full employment act. It's harder for us to do that. I think that's right. The argument would go if progressives want to win the hearts and minds of every American, we should put all our energy into having the government – make jobs available to everyone who doesn't have one. And that's what the president – if you're president and you're looking at that, that might be the right move as president. I'm not president. You're not president. I read the newspaper.
You're president of Consumer Watchdog.
I am president.
You are a president, yeah. And let me go to some web comments for the president of Consumer Watchdog. Here's Andrea from Oakland who says, Michael, could you ask Mr. Court to comment on the stunning effectiveness that the GOP seems to have in defining the battlefield of public opinion? Frank Luntz may have been the most powerful man in America the past 20 years because of his ability to craft certain rhetoric that penetrates the national consciousness. Notwithstanding Will Rogers' famous quote about the Dems, why can't the party ever drive the national debate? Why does it always seem to fight the fight on the ground the GOP defines?
Well, they're very unprincipled, but they're very disciplined. And that's what it comes down to. I mean, you know, this, as I understand it, the Obama administration doesn't have a war room. The GOP had many war rooms when they were in control. The fact is they've been working public opinion. But here's the thing about public opinion. Everyone says, well, public opinion can be co-opted. It may be co-opted. It may be muted. It may be distracted. But it's still the public's opinion. And when the public says 70 or 80% support for an idea like online privacy or health insurance premium regulation, the tech companies can't change that. The insurance companies can't change that. What they can do is say, well, they may want to do that, but they hate government more or they hate government a lot. So we're going to change the terms of the debate to be about government. I think as progressives, we have to totally keep in mind the lessons about framing and what messages work, because particularly on the internet, how authentic messages work and what people believe. But the other issue is in politics, we have to play hardballed, disciplined politics, not just on message, but also in terms of going after the weakest links in our opponents' arguments, forcing their mistakes, finding their Achilles' heels. That's what the GOP did really well. They didn't change public opinion. You know, maybe you could argue over 20 or 30 years they changed public opinion. But in a presidency, you can't really change public opinion that much about an issue. What you can is you can change public opinion about how a president's executing action on that issue. And it's a war. And so to me—
Also frame the debate. You were talking about George Lakoff and using the word morality. They've also framed a lot of debates in terms
absolutely.
Of moral issues, you know, gay marriage and
these
kinds of issues.
And moral sentiments, I talk about in the book how if you want to change anything, you got to express it in moral sentiments. And our communication skills as progressives aren't maybe as good as they should be. Why health reform passed is people believed, look, you shouldn't have to go bankrupt because you don't have health insurance. People believed you shouldn't be turned down for health insurance simply because you're sick.
I think the Obama administration really did a good job at trying to frame it that way and saying this is a moral question. People need health care. They should have health care coverage. As a citizen, you should be concerned morally about others.
But they still didn't get
the numbers in the polls. They still didn't
get they got them until they went to mandatory health insurance, which has 80% support against it. How do you say morally, we should all be forced to buy health insurance when no one's regulating the cost of that health insurance? And it costs, by the way, for a family of four, $12,000 a year, and you're going to have to pay up to 8% of your income for it. That's not a moral debate. The moral debate is what the judge said on the front page of the New York Times today, the conservative judge. He said it's not the business of government to tell us to buy a private commodity in the private market.
The funny thing is that was a Republican idea to begin with, and actually it was the—
It's the insurance industry's idea to begin with.
Well, yeah. It was really the adamant Republicans. I'm thinking about people like Limbaugh and Mark Levin and so forth who were so— They used that rhetoric of Obamacare right from the beginning. I mean, they branded it as being socialist and all the rest of those kinds of things. And somehow a lot of the American public, I'm afraid, bought it.
I would love to live with socialism. I would love for it to really be socialist, to say, okay, you're right. We are going to provide a universal coverage to every American. We're going to put everybody in Medicare. And it's going to cover it. And if you want to go to the private insurer, you know what? You can opt out and go to Blue Cross.
Actually, in fact, George McGovern said on the show, and it was so simple and so easy and so – he said, Medicare for everybody. That's how it should have been framed from the beginning, just Medicare for everybody.
And I can tell you we're going to try a California Medicare program in California regardless of what happens, because I think Californians, from the polls I read, are for it.
Okay. Now that gets us right into the initiative process, which has so much to do with your raising hell and your whole attempt to sort of proselytize and spread the message here. And this is a question that I think is worth asking. Listener writes, I understand Jamie's affinity to California's proposition system, by which he means the initiative system, but the same system has led California into the worst state budget crisis in the country. Take, for example, Prop 13 that has ultimately gutted K-12 spending. How does one balance direct democracy versus reasoned budgeting? There has been talk of a constitutional convention to change the system. In fact, that's something George Lakoff has been working toward, just to mention him again. But does Mr. Court have suggestions for that process?
I think we do need reform of the ballot measure process. Clearly been something that corporations enabled to use at times. And certainly, you know, look, Prop 13 was a populist rebellion, and it was a populist rebellion that has undoubtedly crippled our public education system and other local resources. The answer to that is going back to the ballot and trying to undo it, which I don't think is doable right
now.
Because people don't because of this. People don't trust
government.
It may
be doable for non-private property. It may be doable for commercial property.
I think that's exactly right. I think we could do it on a split roll initiative, which would say commercial real estate hasn't been assessed at the appropriate value. But for the ballot measure process, look, I like it because, look, if I have an idea, I can file an initiative. And yes, it takes a lot to get the 700,000 signatures I'm going to need to qualify for a ballot. But I can put that before the voters. And if it stands on 70% public opinion, there's a good chance, no matter how much the other guy spend against me, I'm going to win. I can do things I can't do. I think the changes in the ballot measure process that are needed are we need to get back to more volunteer-driven signature gathering because we have paid signature gathering, which leaves it at the disposal of anybody. There should be ways to delineate between volunteer-gathered signatures on initiative and paid signatures. I think we should be able to use online means, potentially, digitally, to be able to do online signature gathering, something we explore.
We really need to clean up the process. I think you're absolutely right.
And also the financing of initiatives, is unlimited financing of initiatives. We need better disclosure of who's behind every initiative so that the real sponsors can't hide. But I still...
Too easy to hide now, isn't it?
Sure is. I mean, you know, we have initiatives where you hide behind a phony campaign committee name. You're supposed to mention at the end of that the top two donors to an initiative, but oftentimes that's some other phony committee, so or foundation. So the reality is we can change those things about the initiative process, but I won't give it away. There are people who say we should let the legislature edit initiatives before they go to the ballot or enact something that's part of the initiative as a way of keeping the initiative from being on the ballot. We have privacy, financial privacy rights in the state only because a guy named Chris Larson, who's the CEO of eLoan, collected $700,000 signatures, went to the legislature and said, we better have financial privacy. I'm going to file this initiative in a week. And you know what? With the help of Jackie Speier, Larson got financial privacy. I mean, it is the big stick to hang over politicians, and it doesn't always work for progress if you're progressive, but it does always work if you're thinking about things from what 60 to 70% of Californians want.
From Santa Rosa, Michael, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hello. I've got a couple of questions about how to engage in a couple of ideas that I have. One is, it seems like we need a constitutional amendment that defines citizen as a human being, which would strip corporations from being able to have equal protection. So how would one go about that? And failing that, how do progressives who want to raise hell get that 70% of people say, okay, it's broken in Washington, corporations rule, you're talking about good governance, yes. We don't have good governance because everybody's in the pocket of big corporations, mostly. So how do we get the kind of leadership or public opinion of California and maybe the whole West Coast declaring sovereignty to form a more perfect union? What do you think?
Well, I think we lead by example. I tell you, if we pass a California Medicare program, you could call it a public option to the private market, a public insurance program, buys insurance, whatever you say, and you put that with keeping the private market but regulating their premiums, and it starts in California, it'll quickly spread to D.C. This happened with the patients' rights movement. We passed the toughest laws in 1998. I talk in the book about how we did it. We forced politicians who didn't necessarily want to do it to do it. They did it. And it spread all around the country, even back to Washington. The fact is it's about leading by example through the initiative process. You know, my last book was a book called Corporateering, How Corporate Power Steals Your Personal Freedom and What You Can Do About It. I think that was may have been the last time I was actually in studio. I get the idea of corporate personhood, but to change it will take a constitutional convention, a U.S. constitutional convention, which could really open our Constitution up to a lot of other sentiments the Tea Party might like to put in it. And I'm not so sure we want to do that. there are people in D.C. who are talking about creating a provision. I think the Democrats are really serious about to have shareholders have to approve campaign expenditures, which I think is a way to at least limit and have greater transparency, I think, about who's paying for campaign ads. This is at least a middle ground to make sure that when you're seeing ads, you know who's paying for them, and if you can organize as shareholders, which is not always easy, you can maybe stop some of the money from going into the political campaigns.
Let me thank you, Michael, for your call. And here's Bill from Novato who comments on our website. I'm not a progressive. I am an unaffiliated independent voter who voted Republican most of my life but voted for Obama. I've been baffled watching him cave over and over to the GOP. He seems like a babe in the woods, totally naive to how D.C. works. It appears he still hasn't learned playground lesson number one. If you never punch the bully in the mouth, he will forever take your lunch money. Telling him you want to be friends ain't going to work. And here's Robert, who writes, somehow at the turn of the 20th century, we went from Gilded Age laissez-faire capitalism to the progressive movement, from Hearst papers creating the Spanish-American War to objective journalism and corporate investigations. How did that happen? What can we learn? Another listener from up in Healdsburg, Lynn, says, in this morning's Santa Rosa Press-Democrat, the editorial explains how many of those that insist on mandatory automobile insurance balk at the idea of mandatory health insurance. I'd like to reiterate, how come those that want to get government out of our lives want to regulate marriage and a woman's right to choose? And David from Petaluma says, would you have your guests comment on the recent article in the New York Magazine alleging that the Tea Party and by inference the populist anger in the U.S. has been co-opted by the Koch brothers?
Koch.
It's Koch.
It's pronounced
right.
Koch, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they certainly
they fund the Tea Party.
I don't know
how
to pronounce their name, but I know they've had a considerable influence as far as money is concerned. They funded a lot of the Tea
they
Party.
Funded. They also funded Prop 23, the repeal of the Global Warming Act, right, where the Tea Party was very active in the failed campaign to do that.
And another listener says, since Google is a private company that makes money off advertising, would they be justified in charging people who don't want to be tracked?
Good question. They might try it. And we'll see how much your privacy is worth if they do it.
Jamie, we come to the end of the hour. Always good to see you. Good to have you on the air. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Jamie Court's book, again, is A Progressive's Guide to Raising Hell, How to Win Grassroots Campaigns, Pass Ballot Box Laws, and Get the Change We Voted For, A Direct Democracy Toolkit. And he is president of Consumers Union, the watchdog that is located in L.A., but there's an office also on Capitol Hill where they have to be. We are here with you. We have to be here with you. Not necessarily by law, but we want to be also every Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to also remind you, you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by calling 415-553-3300 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.